On Friday, October 16th, 1959, a Polish rabbi and a Roman Catholic public official met. And there was an exchange of money between the two, which I guess if you think about Jewish history, maybe that's not so uncommon. But this was a very uncommon, historic, and controversial exchange of money between the rabbi and the public official. This Friday, October 16th, was Erev Shabbos, and it was Erev Sukkos, 1959. The rabbi was a Polish Rav. His name was Rav Menachem Tzvi Eisenstadt. He was born in Warsaw. He was a student of Rav Chaim Halevi Soloveitchik, of his son, the Briska Rav. He was a member of the Krakow City Council. At the beginning of the war, he moved to Vilna, where he was involved in directing the yeshiva of Chachmei Lublin. Ultimately, he was able to get to Israel in 1941, and in 1947, he moved to the United States. The official with whom he was meeting was the mayor of New York City, a man by the name of Robert F. Wagner, Jr. His father, Robert F. Wagner, was a famous U.S. senator who was responsible. He was one of the co-sponsors of the Social Security Act. So he was born into the royalty of Democratic New York politics, and he rose up to become the mayor. At first, he was involved in Tammany Hall. This was during his second term. And Rabbi Eisenstadt meets Mayor Robert F. Wagner and exchanges, and he pays him off. He gives him $1. Why does he give Robert Wagner $1? He gives him $1 because he would like to lease the rights over the entire borough of Manhattan for the construction of an Eruv. And the mayor, I checked in the New York Times, this didn't even make the papers. Didn't make the New York Times. But the mayor did accept $1 from Rabbi Eisenstadt to enable the functioning of the Manhattan Eruv. I don't know if for this mayor this was a controversial day, or if it was just 5 minutes with some guy walking into his office with a beard who's giving him $1. But that was the linchpin of one of the great controversies, which is it never has been and never will be settled in America regarding the construction of an Eruv. Let's take a step back to understand what was so significant about this meeting, why it was important, and who is involved. So let's start a little bit with a who's who, which is on the back of your front cover of your packet. The Manhattan Eruv, the story of the Manhattan Eruv, begins with the rabbi on the top left, Rav Yoshua Siegel, Zichrono Livracha. He was born in Poland, and he served as a rav in a community called Sherps before coming to America. So when he came to America, he was known as the Sherps Rav. Some of who are familiar, there was, at the turn of the 20th century, there was a centralized, so to speak, chief rabbi in New York, Rabbi Yaakov Yosef, Rabbi Jacob Joseph. He was not universally accepted, and Rav Siegel, the Sherps Rav, was kind of like the the breakaway. So he had like 20 shuls, 20 communities in the Lower East Side, which is where the way overwhelming majority of tens and tens of thousands of Jews, well over 100,000 Jews, all these immigrants, many of them settled on the Lower East Side. So there were 20 shul and 20 communities that were associated with Rav Siegel. So the Sherpsa Rav became the leader of the Polish community in the Lower East Side. And in 1905, he constructed an Eruv for the Lower East Side. We're going to talk about what that is in a couple minutes and what it means. But this construction of this Eruv met with significant rabbinic opposition. However, at the time, you could not mess. I shouldn't say you could. You could. But if you're like me, if you come from Galicia, which is where my father's family comes from, you cannot start up with this Eruv. Because this Eruv had a haskama. It had a rabbinic approbation, not just from some significant rabbis in the New York area, but from none other than the Maharsham. The Maharsham is in the middle of your page, Rav Sholem Mordechai HaKohen Shvadron. The Maharsham was the Rav of a small Galatianish, maybe not so small, Brezhin. He was the recognized Galatianish Gaon at the beginning of the 20th century. So this Sherpsa Rav sent a letter with the details of his circumstance to the Maharsham in Europe, in Poland, sends him all of his suggestions, and the Maharsham writes him back, based on what you're telling me, it's okay to build an Eruv. Meanwhile, later, one of the opponents, the opposition, went to meet with the Maharsham in person to explain to him, no, it's not what he said, it's totally different. And in 2000, Maharsham, I think, died maybe in 1908 or something like that. When did he die? 1911. There was a letter that was revealed that the Maharsham wrote to this other fellow saying, I only wrote to the Sherpsa Rav based on what he told me, but based on what you're saying, you cannot construct the Eruv on the Lower East Side. This was not known until the year 2000. This is a whole nother thing. Fast forward several years, in 1949, the Amshinava Rebbe, Rav Shimon Shalom Kalish, and this Rav Zvi Eisenstadt began to look into the possibility of a Manhattan Eruv, because many thousands of the immigrants who were living on the Lower East Side migrated, and they moved north. So this became the question. So if you want more information about this, there is a fascinating, absolutely fascinating PhD dissertation by Rabbi Adam Mintz of the Upper West Side. So you can read all 433 pages. I didn't read them all, but I read a chunk of it in preparation for today, where he catalogs this in a very, very fascinating way. He has a chapter on the Toronto Eruv. He has a chapter on the St. Louis Eruv, which preceded the Manhattan Eruv. A whole big discussion. Who gets into the fray in the late 40s, early 50s? The man who is pictured on the top right, that's Rav Menachem Mendel Kasher. Rav Kasher was a European, and I just want you to understand, I'm not qualified to talk about these people. It would be like saying, stand next to Mount Kilimanjaro and tell me from the base, how tall is it? Rav Kasher, it's hard to explain. Rav Kasher had a work that he published called Torah Shlema. I don't know if you've ever heard of it. It's essentially an encyclopedic work before the advent of Bar Ilan or computers, where he collects every medrash, Mechilta, Psikta, Medrash Rabbah, anything that has to do on the Chumash, sequentially by Pasuk, with enormous footnotes and huge scholarly essays in the back. I can't measure genius, but the enormity of this project that this man undertook is beyond comprehension. So he was a recognized Gaon in Europe. He came to Israel for a brief period of time, then he went to New York for a while. He was affiliated, he had a little machon that Dr. Belkin, Zichrono Livracha, the president of YU, had set up. This picture, I actually got from a small newspaper, some Jewish newspaper, Gazette, that had published a photo of the first dinner of the founding of YU in its Yeshiva College iteration in 1946. Who was one of the guests seated at the dais? You see, that's why he's wearing a cap from a commencement gown. They raised $1 million at this 1946 dinner. Was none other than the Gaon Rav Menachem Mendel Kasher. Rav Kasher, he becomes involved and a protagonist for building the Eruv. And he writes about this. If you want more, there is a tremendous amount that he writes in his Divrei Menachem. It's published in his four volumes that he published. He also wrote a lot about Israel and tons before he made Aliyah. I think he won the Israel Prize himself for rabbinic literature. He was just a tremendous person. And he was very integrally involved in this process, so he has a lot of documentation. He quotes many of the letters that you'll see in a few minutes in the back here. Some of them come from his Svarim, his essays. Part of this was actually translated in a 30-page pamphlet into English, edited by Rabbi Shalom Carmi. I have to thank, there was an older colleague of mine, his name is Rabbi Moshe Shapiro, who works in the YU library. So sometimes, it's about, yeah, you need to call out, sometimes you need a favor. So I needed to get a hold of this English. So the problem was, by the time I got him, so it used to be, my brother was in YU, so he could take out books, and I would pay him to ship them to me. But then into library, at Kitzer, so he said he checked with the copyright, and he was not sure that it was legal, but he did scan all 30 pages of this pamphlet and send it to me. So I did not, it's not given out for free, but I want to thank Rabbi Shapiro for helping me prepare the shiur, because he did scan all the book and just send it to me so I could read it. Rav Kasher was very involved, and he started talking to many of the Rabbanim who were involved in this controversy, in this question of whether or not you could build an Eruv. One of the major poskim who was living, I think, in Brownsville at the time, was Rav Yonasan Steif, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who was a proponent of the Eruv, among others. However, probably the two most well-known New York rabbinic luminaries, Gaone Olam, who did not see eye to eye on this Eruv, are the two men pictured together in this picture. On the right side is a Gaon, Rav Yosef Elio Henkin, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Rav Henkin was a European Rav who was formerly, his job was to be the head of Ezra's Torah. Many of you are familiar with Ezra's Torah that started in New York. He wrote many tshuvas, and he was, I guess you could call him, the senior contemporary of Rav Moshe. They were colleagues. He was a little bit older than Rav Moshe. Rav Moshe, and he had tremendous respect for each other. And to the left, you see, this is Rav Moshe Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Rav Moshe was involved in a lot of discussions about the Eruv, and Rav Moshe, as we will see, opposed the Eruv, while Rav Henkin also had questions and involvement in the Eruv, but ultimately, he, at its core, he supported the project of the Eruv. So these are some of, although there are many others, and many of them are notable, and we'll talk about them as we go along, but if you're talking about who is involved in this controversy, you're talking about literally the greatest Torah personalities of the last century living in America. Yes?
Rabbi Bechofer, who was at IU,
he wrote a book. He wrote a book on Eruvin, Rabbi Yosef Gabriel Bechofer. I didn't mention it before. Yes, there's also an excellent book if you want to build an Eruv. So you should spend a couple of years learning. And get this book. It's written by two members of the Chicago Community Kollel, the Lakewood Kollel, Rabbi Shlomo Francis and Rabbi Yonasan Glenner. They did a beautiful job on this new volume on Eruvin. And what's nice about it is that they have a lot of pictures and diagrams so that you can get a good sense of what it is that they're talking about. So it's a great book. It's very useful. So these are the people who are going to be back and forth in this issue. But the real question that we need to learn together a little bit is to understand, what is an Eruv? What is an Eruv? There is a big discussion in general about our attitude toward Eruvin, but many poskim, including Mori Barabi Rav Schechter, whose article on Eruvin I sent out to you, I sent it to you because it's a very easy to read, easy to digest overview of some of the things we're going to talk about. We're not even going to talk about everything in the article, but you have it, you can read it later. Rav Schechter quotes in the Chasam Sofer, and many others do, and Rav Kasher quotes as well, that it is proper to pursue building an Eruv. based on Gemara and Erevin, we want to encourage the building of Erevin. So why? Because the purpose of an Erev is to bring people together. It means, Arev means to mix. It brings people together. What's the origin? The origin of the Erev is that there is, we know, in Isser, one of the 39 malachos is the prohibition against hotza'ah. So there are two forms of hotza'ah. There is taking something from a private domain, which we'll define what this is in a few minutes, a private domain, picking it up, carrying it out to a public domain, and putting it down. That's one form of hotza'ah. Another derivative of hotza'ah is called ha'avara maver dalet amos b'rishus harabim. I have something, I pick it up in the Rishus HaRabim, the public square, that's called Akira. I picked it up, I carry it four amos. So let's say that an ama is somewhere between 18 and 22, 24 inches, something like that. So I probably carry it right over here. I put it down. Both of those are Rishus HaRabim. That's an Issa Doraisa, that's a Chiyuv Stila of Hutzah. So this idea that I'm going to carry out from one domain and put it down into another domain, that's an Issa Doraisa. Shlomo HaMelech came along and he said, wait a second. What if you have people, they live next door to each other, so I have a spoon and you want to borrow my spoon, so I'm going to take the spoon from my Rishus HaYachid and I'm going to carry it to your Rishus HaYachid and I'm going to put it down. But we have a yard and we have a driveway. It's very reasonable to suspect that people are going to get confused. And if they start carrying from my Rishus HaYachid to your Rishus HaYachid, they're going to end up, unwittingly, invariably, they're going to end up carrying out into Rishus HaRabim, into a public thoroughfare. So therefore, Shlomo HaMelech made a takana. He made an enactment that you may not carry, even from your personal domain to somebody else's personal domain, and there's no public thoroughfare at all. Your neighbors, you're adjacent to each other, unless you are ma'ariv, unless you mix together, unless you create a partnership. So what is an Eruv? An Eruv is a partnership. What is the best way to bring people together? Everyone knows this in the Welt Arayim. Everyone's talking about it now. Why? Because this is 2 weeks before the worldwide, or at least in America, the American Thanksgiving dinner. This is the time when everyone's talking about how food brings people together, right? Imagine trying to explain to a coworker that we have Thanksgiving every Friday night, right? But this is the Indian. If somebody asks you, what is an Eruv? The answer is, it's food. That's the Eruv. The Eruv has nothing to do with strings and poles. Now, what I just said is not really true. Of course it has to do with strings and poles, but that's not what an Eruv is. An Eruv is shared food, which is why, let's say you go to some place where you rent a house. You have two families, they rent a big house, you're going to have a Shabbos together, so they bring you Sefer Torah, they bring all the food, and one house becomes the food house, and everyone's eating together. Well, everyone's eating together. That's your food that you're all eating together. So you have two adjacent houses. You don't need more food. You don't need to make another Eruv. That's your food. You're all eating together. That's your place. The Eruv is the food. In addition to the food, you all have to be together in one Rishus HaYachid. So you have to have partitions, which we'll explain in a minute. But then there is a third criterion. So if you look on page 2, we're going through our little outline over here. The third criterion is permission. And this is something that maybe some people don't know about. This on the right-hand side, you have in tiny letters, I got the proclamation. This is from the Glenbrook Eruv. We used to have here in the hallway, they used to have the the Skokie Eruv. They used to have outside in the glass the permission. The Gemara says the following. If, let's say, I have neighbors. We have neighbors right now who live next to us, and we're contiguous properties. So in theory, citizens, we could just make an Eruv between the two properties. We can share some food, and we can put a fence around the two properties and put a little door between them, and that's fine. We don't need permission from anybody else. We own it. But here's the tricky part. Let's say you live in a cul-de-sac where you have Nachrim, non-Jews. The Gemara has a special iser, a special prohibition that you may not, You may not construct an Eruv, a group together, with that Nachri is involved, unless you rent the property from him. You have to actually, you can't just ask him to do what we could call bitul rishus, which would work for a Jewish person. You could say, you know what, I'll give you permission to use my thing. That's not enough. You have to actually rent it from him. And the Gemara has a reason for that, because they didn't want Jews and non-Jews living in the same confines. They wanted to avoid that. So the third thing that you need is permission. If everybody in this Eruv is all Jewish and they all agree, so then that's fine. But if they don't, you have to rent the property. So let's go through these three things one at a time so we make sure we understand them very clearly. Food. So we should know that there is a difference. There are two kinds of what we could call Eruv. There is an Eruv Chatzeros. A Chatzer is a specific structure of a courtyard where you have multiple homes that's open into a courtyard. Then there's something called Shitufei Muvos, where you have two alleys or two streets that are grouped together in, maybe you could even call it a subdivision. So those are very similar, but they have some differences. We're not going to get into that today. One of the differences may have to do with not just appearances in the walls, which you're not going to talk about today, but we are going to assume that if you want it, you want to cover your bases, we're going to treat our Eruv also like an Eruv, also like Shitufei Mavos. You're going to need bread. The food that you're going to need is pas. What do they use today? If I'm not mistaken, I think the Eruv might be in there. Is it there? Ira, is it in there?
Not there.
You sure? No one ate it. It better be there, otherwise we're going to have tsaras. Why do you use matzah? That's right, because of less. In the old days, they didn't use matzah. You know what they probably did in the old days? That's right. Every Friday, somebody would come and would put two challahs there, whatever. How much food do you need? So you need one grogeris, so that's a fig size, for every family, every unit. But once you get to 18, that's your max. So you can have 18 grogros, which is why I think if they have one box of matzah, right? One box of matzahs, that's enough for you could have hundreds and thousands of people. But that matzah has to belong to everybody. So what they'll do is, probably Erev Pesach, I think that's the minig, right before Pesach, they change out the matzah. The rabbi will do the same thing like you see at a wedding. They will do a zechiah. So let's say somebody, the rabbi will pick up the box of matzahs, and by picking it up, by doing that hakbah, he's picking it up on behalf of everyone. Which means that legally, if God forbid, lo aleinu, somebody in this room or somebody we know, God forbid, were hungry on a Shabbos, Rachman Litzlan, they didn't have any food, what would they do? They would go and they would eat the matzah and the Eruv. And that would be totally legal. It would not be stealing. Adrabah, if you couldn't eat it, then you're not part of the Eruv. The point is that the Eruv belongs to everybody. And if, God forbid, somebody was hungry, they would be allowed to eat the Eruv. Now, we don't want people eating the Eruv because we want to make sure that it's there at the beginning of Shabbos. Yeah. That's okay, because once Shabbos starts, everybody is part of the Eruv. That's one of the differences between the food and the partitions, which we're going to talk about. If, God forbid, the partitions fall down on Shabbos, that's a problem for the Eruv. If the food is eaten on Shabbos, that's the whole point of the Eruv. The point is we should all have a meal together. So at the beginning of Shabbos, we have the matzah, we can all have the Shabbos food tomorrow, we can all eat up all the matzah, and then next Friday, we put more food. So theoretically, somebody could come, it's not a problem. Not
make
the
bracha each time or not?
So I think they do make a bracha each time when they make the Eruv. I would think so. Yeah, it's a new Eruv. It's a new thing. Oh. So that's in terms of the food. Let's talk about the partitions. The way to think about partitions relates to the second element on the page here, which is the Dalad Rishuyos, the four areas on Shabbos. The Gemara says at the beginning of Masechta Shabbos on Daf Vav Amud Aleph, Dalad Rishuyos L'Shabbos. There are four areas of Shabbos. Tosus thinks there should be five, but he explains why we only qualify it, that there are only four. What are those four? Rishus HaYachid, Rishus HaRabim, Karmelis, and Makom Patur. So what are these? The Gemara says, what is Rishus HaYachid? Charitz. a ditch which is 10 tefachim deep and 4 tefachim wide, or goder, or a fence, which is 10 tefachim high. So, if you have a fence, you have a partition, this is a perfect example. Here you have a partition. This is way more than 10 tefachim high. This whole room, because we're surrounded by mechitzos, by partitions, this qualifies as a reshus hayachid. It's a private domain. This, I would have to measure how high the gap is from the bottom to here. But let's say this went to the floor. Is this more than 10 tefachim high? It sure is. Let's say a tefach is approximately 4 inches. So 40 inches. This is well over 40 inches. So this would also constitute a mechitza. So you can have either a mound, it could be at the top of a mound, and you look around the mound and there is a 10 tefachim slope at the bottom, then you wouldn't need mechitzos. There's also something called good hasik mechitzos. This mechitza in halacha, we view it as if it goes to the sky. This mechitza right here, it's as if it's stretched all the way up, and then it goes all the way down. But you don't even need that. If you were standing on the top of a mound, imagine this thing at the bottom. There was no, this is probably a good mechitza also. I don't know how tall this is. But if you're standing at the top of a mound and you look around and you see there's 10 tefachim on each side all the way, you're in your own reshus hayachid, even though there's nothing around you, because the mechitzos, the partitions, are at the bottom. So you can have partitions around you, or you can have partitions at the bottom. That's reshus hayachid. Reshus harabim. What is the reshus harabim? The Gemara says it's a strati or a platia. It's a massive place. It's a huge place. Carmelis. So we're going to have to get back in a little bit more into each one of these in a few minutes. And trust me, this is just scratching the scratching of the surface. Okay. Carmelis is not a reshus harabim. Reshus harabim is a huge, massive highway thoroughfare. Let's say you live on a street that's called Sleeping Bear. Right? So how could that be a reshus harabim? Like, it's a small, but at the same time, it's not a reshus hayachid. There are no partitions around it. So that's what we call a carmelis, which means like an in-between area, which the Rabbanan treated like a reshus harabim. You may not carry in there. You need to enclose it to carry in it if it's a drabana. And then there's something called a makom ptur. A makom ptur is a space that is, it's essentially like a dead zone in halacha. It's so insignificant. So it's an area which is less than 4 tefachim by 4 tefachim in area, and it's more than 3 tefachim high. So for example,
top of the shtender.
Yeah, the top of the shtender. This is a good example. Is this 1, 2, 3? That's probably not 4 by 4. So the top of this shtender, or sometimes you see it on the street. Remember the old school mailboxes? Right? So mailbox, if you put something on the top of the mailbox, that's heter gomer. That's not considered a makom. It's a makom ptur. There's no issue of carrying there. So when you want, now that we know what the Baal Rishuyos are, when you want to make an Eruv, you want to create a Rishus Hayachid, that we're all together in one house and we're all eating the same food together. So what do we need to do? We need to put up mechitzas. We need to put up walls. So in some places, that's easier said than done. How do you put up walls? Okay, so you, Sigismund, you can put up barriers. Well, here's the question. What happens if I have a breach in the wall? It's called a pirtza. So depending on the size and how many, that could pose a problem. But look at this for a second. Does this pose a problem for the wall? Is this not called a wall anymore? Of course it's called a wall. It's just a wall that has a door in it. Now, let's do the following. Imagine, let's say we took out the wall, especially this is very in now in construction. Open concept. There's no door, there's just a doorway. So we paskin, first of all, you have to put a mezuzah in a doorway. You don't have to have a door, that's a machlokas we've shown him. But imagine that this door was just not here, and it was just a doorway. Would this be a pirtza in my door? No, it wouldn't be a problem. So this is called a tsuras ha-pesach. The structure, the tsura of a doorway, of an opening. So if I have this doorway, this is not a problem. I could put a sequence of doorways, one next to the other, next to the other. That's how you get a contemporary Eruv. It's a sequence of doorways. This is definitely not as good as an actual wall. The Gemara and the Rishonim discuss how we're very aware of the fact that a series of Tzuras HaPesach does not create the same boundary that a wall does. There are limits to how you can use Tzuras HaPesach, but it also does create, and then there are a couple of other things, like we mentioned Gurasik, where the wall can invisibly go up according to Halakha L'Moshe Mi-Sinai, or sometimes the ceiling can be considered dropping down. It's called Pitik or Yorid Besosim. That's not so important for us right now. And then the last issue of permission, the issue of permission can get a little bit interesting, because on the one hand, if I have a neighbor, and I'm friendly with that neighbor, and that neighbor is not Jewish, and I know him from way back when, I don't know if he would have an issue if I went over to him and I said, do you mind, can I give you $20? And then, according to our Jewish law, I can include you in our cul-de-sac collective for Saturday for the Sabbath. Guy probably wouldn't care. But I don't know how many people want to go door-to-door in the village of Skokie asking every non-Jew, can we rent their property? So this is an interesting question. So these are the basic building blocks of an Eruv: the food, the partitions, and the permission. In a small neighborhood or in a shtetl, building an Eruv is one thing, but building an Eruv in a major metropolitan area is really tricky. So the food, that's the easy part. The permission, that's a little tricky, but the most challenging thing about the Eruv is how do you create an enclosure? Yeah, I know.
But I thought in Manhattan, since it's surrounded by water.
Excellent. Excellent, great. So let's start to talk about Manhattan and why it's such a controversy. Perfect. So first of all, you should just notice that a couple of years ago, there was a lot in the news about the new Eruv in Manhattan, because after a while, the Eruv that we started with, the Manhattan Eruv that was created in 1959, that Rabbi Lookstein wrote a letter explaining how the upkeep of the Eruv was going to be too prohibitive and expensive, so they ended up abandoning that Eruv. There was a new Eruv that was built on the Upper West Side, which was then extended, I believe, to the Upper East Side and now to Midtown. It's a much bigger Eruv, but it's not the same Eruv that was, not because they viewed that it was not acceptable, but because it lapsed in terms of they couldn't maintain it for practical reasons. So there were a lot of interesting articles when they expanded the new Eruv, like you see on the bottom from this NPR article, a fishing line encircles Manhattan, protecting the sanctity of the Sabbath. What I did not want to send you, because I thought maybe it's not possible for a year, was there was several years ago a very humorous sketch that was going around from a particular comedian who's Jewish, who changed his name to something else that doesn't sound Jewish, but he's still very Jewish. And he had a sketch. There was a bit that was done by an African-American guy about Eruvin. He's running around wearing an Eruv hat. Enkan Malkum Laharich. Yes, this guy was trying to explain how he could take a piece of bacon and swirl it around in a glass of milk and eat it because he was inside the Eruv on his hat. So, yes, I can say that. After the shiur. After the shiur, yes.
After the shiur, prayer.
What's that? Yes. That's when you need a break. So what are the issues? Al Regel Achas, and Ira kind of got it started in terms of the Eruv in Manhattan. If you see on the top of the back page, Rav Kasher has in the Kuntris, in a different Menachem, he has the map of Manhattan. North is to the right. So you see New Jersey is on the top, Manhattan is in the middle, and Manhattan is surrounded by the Hudson River on the left side, the East River on the right side, see Staten Island at the bottom. At that time, I believe there were 18 crossings getting into the island of Manhattan. So the first question is, let's talk about the mechitzos. The food is easy. Let's try to keep track. So Iris says, wait a second, I have a great idea. We mentioned that a tail, a mound, if you have a slope at the bottom of that mound, that should constitute a mechitza. So wouldn't we suggest that the entire United States has mechitzas on both ends from the continental shelf. You have on the Atlantic side, and you have on the Pacific side. You have mechitzas. So the Rishon and the Balei HaTosfos and the Ritva, they are not a fan of this. They think that doesn't work. Why not? They say that's ridiculous. That's not what Shlomo HaMelech had in mind. And there are multiple issues there. One option might be, you know why it's a problem? Because if you live in Boise, Idaho, or in Nebraska, or Kansas, you can't see the Atlantic Ocean. Right? I know where we live, everyone always tells us, you know, especially when we moved here, which way am I going? It's to the lake. It's as if like you're supposed to be able to see the lake from downtown Skokie. Right? You see, it's to the lake. It's to the lake. So that's one problem. The mechitzas that are natural mechitzas, they don't work if you don't sense that you're confined in them in any way. The other issue is that there's going to be a difference between mechitzas that are man-made versus natural mechitzas on the issue of what's called asi rabim. The people come and walk umavatli mechitza, and they negate the mechitza. There's a difference between a man-made mechitza and a non. But the first point that Ira's making is where the Sherpa Rav, Rav Siegel, got started. He said, wait a second, if you go around Manhattan, you see they have all of these embankments built up along the sides. So not only is there a man-made mechitza, but there are also, not only are there natural mechitzas from the water line, the shore, but there's also man-made mechitzas in a lot of these places. So this is one suggestion. The Chacham Tzvi, who was the Rav in Amsterdam in the 17th century, the Chacham Tzvi has a tshuva about building an Eruv in the Hague, their Hag, Hey Aleph Gimel, where he points out that all the canals running around the Hague, they all form mechitzas because the bank of the side of the canal, that's a great mechitza. Terrific.
Same in Chicago.
We could have a similar thing in Chicago. That's right. Because the Chicago River, where it cuts around. Exactly. Not only that, we pointed out that you can have a Tzuras HaPesach, and the Gemara has a principle that you can use a Lechi HaOmei Me'ilof, something that exists before. Well, what if you have what they call the L, which we also have here, I think here they call it the loop, there they called it the L. What did the L stand for? Elevated train. So you have a train where the tracks run across, and underneath the tracks, you have steel beams, so you have a Korah, which is the top, and then you have the Lechis that come down from the side. So if you follow the elevated tracks, it's very often very similar to, you could put little lechis there. Lechis are the side posts. Korah is the top. So if you have, the Gemara says, this is how you make what's called a Tzuras HaPesach. You have lechi, one side post, 10 tefachim here, and lechi, one side post here, and then kana al gabeim, kana mikan, kana mikan, kana al gabeim. And the Gemara says that this top, it doesn't even have to be very strong. It could be a kolder. The sides have to be machzik delas shalkash, but just a very thin door, because they've got to be like a doorway, but the top, it could just be a fishing line. So, let's say, yesterday I walked to Lincolnwood, so I saw on the way, there was a, where you go by the train tracks, you could see on the left side, if you look carefully, there is a slab that looks like this, right next to the train tracks, and then if you look up, you can follow, if you had a plumb line, you could look up and you could see that there's a wire that runs right across that slab. So here's my lechi, it's 10 tefachim, it's going to go all the way up, and I see on the top, this is what you'll find, sometimes you'll see lechis that are attached to telephone poles, and the telephone wires are running on top, so you had the elevated, so this is what the Sherpa Rav got started with. He said you have the embankments in Manhattan, and then you have the elevated train. Okay, you have a small problem, slash a big problem. The big problem is that we started by saying that there's a difference between a Carmelis, which is a rabbinic public area, and a Rishus HaRabim, which is a huge area. If you have a Rishus HaRabim, a biblical public area, it is very difficult to create an Eruv. Why? Because once you get to the level of Rishus HaRabim, that it's mamish, a public thoroughfare, think about that. How can you change a major public thoroughfare into just your private property? You would have to do something really substantial. Many Rishonim assume that if it's an absolute Rishus HaRabim de Oraisa, then the only way to encounter, to encircle that would be actual walls. That not Tzuras HaPesach, that this whole idea of Tzuras HaPesach will not work. One of the reasons given by some of the Rishonim is that since people are constantly walking through the Tzuras HaPesach, if you have a Rishus HaRabim D'Oraisa, then you're going to invalidate these doorways because they're obviously not serving as partitions. Only if you have a Rishus HaRabim Midrabanan, a Carmelis, can you construct an Eilim. Well, what is the Rishus HaRabim D'Oraisa? We skipped over this a little bit before. The Gemara just said Stratia, Platia. So it's modeled after the Jewish people encamping in the desert, traveling in the desert. So how many feet was the path, was the road in the desert? Tes Zayin Amah, 16 Amos. So Rosh Hashanah Rabbim, it's got to have 16 Amos wide. If it says 16 Amos wide, it belongs to the public property. It's not someone's private driveway that's 16 Amos wide. And you have a ton of people going there. It's a public thoroughfare. That is a Rosh Hashanah Rabbim D'Oraisa. Wait a second. A Sleeping Bear Road is 16 Amos wide, and it belongs to the village of Skokie. Could it be that it's a Rishus HaRabim D'Oraisa? Well, you should know that in Europe, as we said before, this issue of Eruvin in metropolitan areas has a long history, already from the Chacham Tzvi. There were other major cities that had Eruvin. Think Warsaw, and in the 1930s, Rav Eliel Monk, traveled to Vilna to see the Gaon Rav Chaim Moser Grzesinski about putting an Eruv in Paris. These are big cities, and they were able to create Eruvin. So how did they do that? Well, there's an opinion in the Rishonim. It's not the universally accepted opinion, but it is quoted in Rashi and others. Not even every Rashi quotes this, but Rashi says, wait a second, how many people were there in the desert? Exactly, 600,000. So according to... Oh, that's a further discussion. Does it have to be 600,000? Does it have to be more because it's men? The further discussion is it 600,000 people living in the city? Is it 600,000 people traveling through the city? Is it 600,000 people on the same road? And maybe there's also a difference between the city environment versus an interstate highway. Let's say 94. It could be that you don't even need 600,000 people on 94 because it's considered an interstate highway. That's a bona fide Rishus HaRabim on its own. So this is the first core issue. Rav Aaron Cutler, who was one of the chief opponents of the Manhattan Eruv, said, Manhattan, you can't make an Eruv here. This is absolutely a Rishus HaRabim D'Oraisa. You cannot make an Eruv here. Doesn't work. Can't work. One other way of thinking about this, that Rav Moshe does not accept in his tshuva. It's a long tshuva, the end of Or HaChaim Chelek Aleph. But Rav Shechter quotes this, and Rav Kasha quotes this from Rav Shlomo David Kahana, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, the Rav of Warsaw, is that, wait a second, when the Jewish people traveled in the desert, they traveled on a road that the Gemara says was mefulash. Mefulash means it was unfettered, it was uninterrupted, it was open on both ends. They traveled in the desert. Well, Rav Shlomo David Kahana, he has this suggestion, which Rav Moshe does not like, that it has to be mefulash mishar l'shar, it has to be uninterrupted from one end of the city, but it has to be a straight thoroughfare. The same way that they went straight through the desert, it has to be a straight thoroughfare in the city. And therefore, even Manhattan is not, even Broadway, which goes all the way from Washington Heights down to the bottom, there's some akmimus there. There's some moving around in terms of the direction of the street. It curves, it goes. So Moshe says, he doesn't like that hetch, it doesn't appear in the Gemara. But in Warsaw, they had hundreds of thousands of Jews in Warsaw, they had millions of people in Warsaw. I don't remember exactly how many, but they had well over 600,000 people. They did have an Eruv. And Rav Shlomo David Kahana, who survived the war, he went to Israel, he passed in that this was Mutter. It's a huge controversy. If you add to this mix another factor, which is we mentioned earlier, that sometimes you have mechitzos, but you have pirzos, you have breaches in those mechitzos, that can pose a problem. If they had 18 bridges and tunnels, now you have an Eruv, but you have a Pirtza, an opening out of the city of Manhattan, which is your Eruv, and it's open to a Makom Ha'asur, a place where there's no Eruv, like the George Washington Bridge. So this becomes another question. What do you do about the bridges and the tunnels? Well, one way to look at it is, wait a second, if you look at the George Washington Bridge, how did they build a suspension bridge? You see a giant lechi on one side, a lechi on one side, and a korah on the top. So maybe it's pulled off by a Tzuras HaPesach. Or maybe you can make it Tzuras HaPesach. But then you get kicked back to the previous problem, which is, wait a second, if you have Rishus HaRabim D'Oraisa, it doesn't even get to first base. Because if it's a Rishus HaRabim D'Oraisa, the Tzuras HaPesach is not going to help you at all. So all of these issues become kind of intertwined. And there's even one opinion where Moshe sounds like he wants to be machmer for this, that even if you had actual walls, a Rishus HaRabim D'Oraisa, you can't make an Eruv. And this is why in many communities, they never made Eruvim. Because there were certain approaches of certain Rabbanim. Let's say if you follow the Rambam Shita, the Rambam is very stringent on Eruvim. That's why, if I'm not mistaken, there was no Eruv in Chicago for many years, because Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, the Soloveitchik, followed the Rambam, and there's no...
It was a prison.
Right, that's because they followed the Rambam. And the Rambam would not allow, and Boston also. So Rabbi J.J. Schachter, who was the rabbi of the Jewish Center, a lot of the issues of the Eruv are related to the Jewish Center, because Rabbi Jung, who was the rabbi of the Jewish Center, he corresponded with Moshe about the Eruv. So when Rabbi Schachter became the rabbi of the Jewish Center, taking over for Rabbi Lam, Lahavda ben Chaim Lachaim, he went to speak to Rav Soloveitchik. And he had a couple of shilas about the shul and about how the Balabatim were anything. Not that we complain about Balabatim behind your back. We love all the Balabatim. Everything is great. He had a few issues. So one of the questions that he had was about the Manhattan Eruv. And you know what the Rav said to him? Don't ask me about the Eruv. He said, don't ask me about the Eruv. I'm not the person to ask about the Eruv. Don't ask me. So this, now you can understand. So if you look on the letters... On the left-hand side, you have the people who are signed in support of the Eruv, Rav Yonason Steif, Rav Michal Ber Weissmandel, Rav Menachem Siegel Pollack, the Amshinover. Then on the left side, you see Rav Ephraim Oshri, Rav David Lifshitz, the Suvalka Rav, the Rosh Hashiva NYU, as many others. And now you see on the right side, the tiny letters. This was the letter published after meeting the Agudas HaRabbanim, signed by Rav Moshe Feinstein, Rav Aaron Cutler, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky, and others, that if you make an Eruv, mi sheyismoch al Eruv in Manhattan, yechashiv l'machal Shabbos. If you follow the opinion who says that there's an Eruv in Manhattan, you are considered to be a Machal Shabbos. Where did we start? We started this whole discussion with the exchange between Rav Eisenstadt and Mayor Wagner. This brings us to the third issue. The food, that was not a problem, but the mechitzos, it's very complicated, and now the food is an issue. Because wait a second, you have to acquire the property of every individual person. So what are you going to say? I'm going to go to the mayor. Mayor Van Dusen. Sheyichi l'yom tov baruchim malchuso yimoshe. Does Mayor Van Dusen have the authority to come into my house? You know that one of the foundational principles of the United States was the problem of the Quartering Act. That the British showed up and they had a bunch of soldiers and they said, oh, you look like a very nice family. You're going to host four soldiers and feed them. So we say, was wird sein? What are you talking about? That's not right. We're not going to do that anymore. So it actually becomes very questionable. The chief of police. In some communities, they used to do the schiras rishus in the chief of police, because theoretically, the chief of police could enter into your house. The problem is that even the chief of police can't enter your house without a warrant. So some say that the whole notion of schiras rishus doesn't make sense, because the mayor doesn't have the authority. However, the mitigating argument is to say, no. In times of emergency, if there was a declaration of war, then there would be the potential for a civilian government to occupy your house, not just through eminent domain, but through emergency declaration. And I think this is even, again, in the Congress, I think it's even one of the federal statutes. And so If you think about this question of is it really such a strong heter of the Schiris Rishus, it's not so questionable. You go away for a Shabbos and you're going to make an Eruv in the whole little thing. You're going to say, great idea, I'm going to make an Eruv. We're going to go to this bungalow colony or this Orlando housing development. We're going to rent all the houses. But wait a second, you still have to do the food. You have to check the mechitzos. Wait a second. If that gate at the entry, is there a pirtza there? Is there an opening? But the third issue that sometimes people don't even realize is, wait a second, the streets don't belong to you. And the guy next to you in the non-Jewish house, he doesn't belong to you. So who are you going to do Sirius Rishus from? The condo association? Not so much that you could do what? Why is the Sirius Rishus in the condo association? So maybe it could be. The condo association, theoretically, they could throw you out in the middle of, the Airbnb. They could evict you. But it's not so simple. So this is why you understand that this is such a strong controversy. Because on the one hand, we have this tradition from the Achronim that we want to support people being together. And we want to emphasize, like we said in the name of Chasam Sofer, that we should construct Erevin, and they were Erevin. They didn't end up building it in Paris, but there were Erevin in Warsaw and many other big cities. On the other hand, you could see why people who don't accept the Erev have very good reason to be suspicious of Erevin, because there are a lot of halachic questions and a lot of halachic details that need to be dealt with to make sure that an Eruv is acceptable in every place. So what can be a takeaway for us? So what I would suggest is to understand, number one, be educated. Eruvin is one of the most complicated areas in halacha, and before you get involved in an Eruv, make sure you have Gaone Olam to be educated with. That's number one. And number two, is understand that when it comes to a controversy, like an Eruv, there are multiple opinions. And if you have legitimate Gaone Olam, like you have here in these two opinions, you have to understand that there is only one way. And it could be, and this is what became a huge controversy afterwards in Brooklyn and in other places, it could be that there are some who are going to be machmir, and it's their right to be machmir, and you shouldn't criticize them for being machmir. You should applaud them. But at the same time, they should understand, and if you're one of the machmirim, you shouldn't look down on the people who do use the Eruv, because if they have a legitimate, appropriate, halachic approbation for their Eruv, so then that's fulfilling the Chasam Sofer's encouragement that we should create Eruvin to keep bringing people together.